I think it's safe to say with August 22nd past us, the end of the world, at least as we know it, who knows, it might happen today, but the end of the world as we know it, as many people feared or suspected, because of what the president of Iran had to say about responding to a UN proposal by August 22nd. A lot of people read doomsday scenarios into that. Proved not to be true, but we do need to look at what is going on with Iran. We're going to be talking about Iran's nuclear proposal during this first half hour of Issues Etc. Our good friend, very informative guest, Dr. Serge Trifkovic, will be our guest here in the first 25 minutes. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. This is Issues Etc. You can join our conversation for the next 3 hours, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. In the second half hour, Pastor Jerome Teichmiller will be our guest. We're going to talk about unionism and syncretism. You know, it occurs to me, you might not know what either of those words mean. I guess you'll just have to wait 25 minutes so that Pastor Teichmiller can explain to us what they mean. I'll give you a hint. It has to do with people who, to one degree or another, believe that everybody worships the same God. Either all Christians are worshiping the same God, or all religions are worshiping the same God. We'll be talking about that in about 25 minutes here on Issues Etc. In the second hour, we're going to be talking with Hal Sinkbile about sexual sins. Sex is a good gift, but something has gone seriously wrong, and we abuse the good gift of God. We'll talk about how to deal with that in the context of the church. And then at 4:30, we'll pick up where we left off yesterday with Pastor Peter Bender, part three of our three-part conversation on the Nicene Creed. We'll deal with the person and work of the Holy Spirit. The last half hour of the program today, audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Our call-in numbers again, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. In just a minute, Dr. Serge Trifkovic will join us. But before he joins us, let's get an update from CBS News and the facts on Iran's nuclear proposal.
Iran, never shy about telegraphing its defiance, held weekend military exercises before handing over its answer to the West today. Tehran says it's ready to talk about its nuclear program, but the government's official news agency is saying that Iran will never comply with the UN Security Council demand to stop enriching nuclear fuel, which it says it wants for strictly peaceful purposes, as Iran's president told 60 Minutes.
But if Mr. Bush thinks that he can stop our progress, I have to say that he will be unable to do that.
The U.S. and Western nations fear that Iran wants to build nuclear weapons, and they continue to demand that it cease fuel enrichment.
If they don't, we've also made it clear that their unwillingness to give up their pursuit of nuclear weapons will result in our efforts in the Security Council to obtain economic sanctions against them.
But late today, the Bush administration held its fire instead of demanding sanctions immediately. Stung by criticism that it doesn't seem interested in real diplomacy, it says that it will take some time to digest the Iranian response and consult with allies. But soon, as the president pointed out yesterday, Iran faces a deadline to stop its nuclear program or face sanctions.
The UN resolution calls for us to come back together on the 31st of August. Dates are fine, but what really matters is will. And one of the things I will continue to remind our friends and allies is the danger of a nuclear-armed Iran.
Officials say privately that unless Iran changes its stance before the end of the month, France, Germany, and Britain have all agreed to join with the U.S. in pressing for economic sanctions against Iran. But administration officials believe that Iran is simply playing for time by agreeing to negotiate and giving its trading partners, Russia and China, a good excuse to vote against sanctions at the UN Security Council.
That's the story from CBS News, an update on Iran's nuclear proposal. Joining us to discuss it, Dr. Serge Trifkovic is our guest. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and author of the book Defeating Jihad. Serge, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you again.
First of all, what's your reaction to the Iranian president's response, wherein he speaks for his country, saying they will never comply with the UN's demand that Iran stop enriching nuclear fuels?
Nothing new under the sun. I think it would have been very surprising if the response was either in substance or in form any different than it was. I say in form because the Iranians are past masters of diplomatic negotiations dragging on forever, and I think that one of the major objectives of their 24-page documents is to gain time and possibly to create further rifts within the Security Council, in other words, to give those permanent members who are not willing to introduce sanctions an excuse for asking for more time, clarifications, and so on. But we must be clear on one point, that Iran is entering this episode of the protracted nuclear dispute with a very strong hand. The effective victory of Hezbollah embodied in the UN Security Council Resolution 1701 has made it clear to all and sundry that Iran has the wherewithal to make a very tangible impact on events in the greater Middle East, and everybody knows that their influence over their co-religionists, the Shiites in Iraq, who are two-thirds of the population, is so great that direct Iranian agents have been long infiltrated into the Iraqi security services, and most notably the Interior Ministry. If the United States is serious about pursuing sanctions, the Iranians can press a few buttons that would make an already almost unimaginably difficult situation in Iraq totally unmanageable. And another important point is that even within the European camp, there is not complete unity. It remains to be seen whether and to what extent the reaction of the British, who are expected to side with the United States, the Germans, who may be less willing to do so openly, and the French or Italians, who are not at all happy with the prospect of media sanctions, will be. So on balance, Iran has no incentive to comply right now, because even if it did so, it would not obtain what it has been looking for a long time, which is direct negotiations with the United States that would result in some kind of security guarantee. Also, having raised the nuclear issue to the level of litmus test of national pride and dignity, Iran, which sees itself as a regional power of the first order, would be most unlikely to comply, because it would be seen as a loss of face and a slap to national dignity that the regime simply cannot afford. And finally, I think that everybody realizes that a serious package of sanctions would have to involve sanctions on Iranian oil exports and sanctions on Western investment into the Iranian oil industry. Now, if there was no Iranian production coming online and being available to the rest of the world, we would see oil prices rising to probably above $100 a barrel within days, if not weeks, which could trigger off global economic recession. So I think that while the Iranian response is unsurprising, it's even less so in the light of what came to pass in Lebanon last month and in the light of worldwide anxiety about the price of energy.
Well, let's talk about the price of energy a little bit then. In addition to what you just mentioned, which was if serious sanctions were imposed, to be effective, it has to include their major export, which is probably oil. And that would change the price of a barrel of oil worldwide. What about what many people fear is Iran's ability to affect the price of oil even further, because they control so much of the supply? In fact, not only just the natural effect of taking their oil off the market, raising the price of oil, shortening the supply, but what could they do, if anything, to make it even harder?
Well, the next stage would be for them to close the Straits of Hormuz, which would be an act of war and which they would be reluctant to try for as long as their diplomatic arsenal remains unexhausted. Also, they have the wherewithal, if there were to be a military confrontation, to hit the Gulf states. It's only a short missile ride across the Straits of Hormuz, and I think it should be noted that only a few days ago, the Iranian military had exercises in the course of which short and medium range missiles were tested. But also, I think that it is entirely possible for the Iranians not only to withdraw from the market regardless of whether there are sanctions, if the serious threat of sanctions were to loom large, but to create some kind of bilateral agreements with those powers that could be conduits for the placement of Iranian oil on the world markets, very much in the way that Saddam has had tried to do prior to the war of March 03. Finally, I think that by raising tensions in the region, and as I mentioned earlier, by possibly encouraging the Iraqi Shiites to be less cooperative with the occupation authority, the Iranians could open a whole series of new fronts for the United States, and that's why I think the calls for immediate sanctions regime will be somewhat muted in Washington.
Okay, and that was my next question, and that has to do with already, and as noted in the CBS piece that we heard at the beginning of our conversation, the White House has yet to respond in any real clear way about its intentions with regard to sanctions through the UN, according to the UN call. And I got to wonder how you read, I mean, and this is obviously power play versus power play. How do you read a less than immediate response on the part of the U.S.? Is that smart? Is it indication that they know how strong Iran's hand is?
Well, I think it is smart in the sense that a heavy-handed call for immediate sanctions would fail, and so it is better to make a diplomatic move that does not result in immediate failure. But on the other hand, if there is a muted call for sanctions and if the Security Council decides to fudge the issue and to enter into these prolonged negotiations, again, everybody will know that Iran has effectively won. So it's heads we lose, tails they win. What has to be emphasized is that in the long term, until and unless the Iranians get some kind of bilateral security guarantee from the United States, they will pursue their nuclear program, which is dual-use program, in spite of their protestations that it's for civilian use only, because they feel insecure. They have U.S. troops in Afghanistan to their northeast. They have U.S. troops in Iraq to their west, and of course to the northwest is a NATO ally, Turkey. And for as long as Iran is still officially listed as part of the axis of evil, and for as long as it is still able to pull various buttons and triggers throughout the region, I'm afraid that the Iranian role in the proceedings will not be a constructive one. The question is whether it's at all possible to include Iran in a long-term, constructively devised architecture of the greater Middle East in view of Ahmadinejad's undoubtedly messianic perception of himself as someone who is actively aiding Allah in an eschatological project that will lead to the end times. But this is an altogether different subject, that Ahmadinejad belongs to the so-called Twelver Shiite sect, the majority Shiites, who believe that the second coming of the hidden Imam is imminent and that it will herald the end times. I know it sounds somewhat esoteric, but it is well worth bearing in mind that Ahmadinejad is not altogether a rational player in the diplomatic game.
We're talking with Dr. Sergey Trifkovic about Iran's nuclear proposal. He is a foreign affairs editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, author of the book Defeating Jihad. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. After the bottom of the hour break, we'll discuss unionism and syncretism with Pastor Jerome Tyke Miller. I want to pursue what you just said there, if we could, Sergey. Not an entirely rational participant at the table in this diplomatic effort. What if the president of Iran's views hold sway? what do you think his long-term regional goals are?
I think he has already managed to project himself in the Arab street as the champion and protector of the only group that has been able to not only face Israel, but in the perception of ordinary Muslims, to hold it at bay and even defeat it. So even though there are religious differences of old standing between the mainstream Sunni Orthodox Islam and its Shiite variety, Ahmadinejad has certainly earned many brownie points in the Muslim world as a whole. And let's not forget that in the Arab world, it's not only Iraq that has a sizable Shiite community. There it's two-thirds majority. There are also large Shiite communities in the United Arab Emirates, in Kuwait, and in Saudi Arabia, as well as, of course, Lebanon, where they comprise close to 40% of the population. And in many ways, Ahmadinejad is behaving in a manner similar to the Soviet Union in the early stages of the Bolshevik Revolution, as a dynamic revolutionary power that uses unofficial movements and political groups around the world, or in his case, in the region, in pursuance of his wider design. That design envisages a Shiite commonwealth or a Shiite domain that will extend all the way from the Fertile Crescent and across Syria to the Mediterranean. It also seeks influence in the former Soviet Central Asia, where it clashes, to some extent with the Turks. But at the moment, the Turks are very careful to stay out of this one, because they also sense that the regional influence of Iran is on the rise, and also because Turkey has problems with its own Islamists who have been very sympathetic to Hezbollah in the course of last month's unpleasantness in southern Lebanon. So to cut the long story short, Iran sees itself as a first-rate regional power. Iran wants to get the United States to acknowledge this fact, to accept its security concerns as legitimate, and to enter into a direct dialogue, and Iran will continue pursuing its nuclear program for as long as the United States is reluctant to do so. But the cost to the United States of pursuing escalation with Iran and even envisaging some kind of military response to its refusal will be probably even higher than its acceptance of Ahmadinejad's terms.
Herman is on the line calling from Illinois. Herman, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I would like to ask your guest, if Iran is backing Hezbollah in a military action against Israel, what would really and ultimately in this terms of what's at stake, what would be the worth of a surprise preemptive strike against Iranian nuclear and military facilities?
Good question, Herman. Thank you. Sergio.
Well, the scenario is probably being worked out at the Pentagon and in the basement of the White House as we speak, but it would probably entail three things. One, the closing of the Straits of Hormuz. It would not take a great deal of effort for the Iranians to put some mines in place, which would make it impossible for mega tankers to come to the Emirates or Kuwait. And that would close, and of course, the pipelines from Saudi Arabia's richest field go to the Gulf, not to the Red Sea, which would immediately put out of commission not only Iran's oil fields, but also those of the richest producers in the world. And the result of that escalation would be oil not at 100 plus, but at 150 or 200 plus. It defies imagination, but there are various models out there, and the consequences for global economy would be incalculable. The second consequence is that the Iranians would incite a Shia uprising in Iraq. As I mentioned earlier, they already have a great deal of control through Badr Brigades, which is an offshoot of Revolutionary Guards, over the Iranian Interior Ministry, and a great deal of violence against the Sunnis in Iraq has been perpetrated by people dressed in Iraqi security force uniforms. And those are not pilfered uniforms from some stolen stock. No, they're actually active duty people who are freelancing on the side in pursuit of sectarian strife. And last but by no means least, what kind of military response from the United States and or Israel are we looking at? I don't think that a ground war is on the cards at all. It could be airstrikes, but whether those airstrikes would be effective against the highly dispersed network of centrifuges and against the well-protected underground facility and at Natanz, the one to which the Iranians refused entry to international inspectors only 3 days ago, is a totally different question. In other words, even if Iran were to be frustrated in its immediate nuclear ambitions as the result of such military action, the cost to the rest of the world would be enormous, and the diplomatic standing of the United States, not only with Russia and China, not to mention the Islamic world, but also with its European partners and allies, would be greatly diminished, much more so than in the aftermath of the Iraq war. Finally, it would act as a powerful unifier within Iran itself. It would immediately pull ranks behind Ahmadinejad and make any scenario that entails the moderates, such as Khatami, making a comeback a very distant one indeed.
With only about 30 seconds, no more, what did you make of Mike Wallace's interview on 60 Minutes with Iran's president?
I think that it's funny how unassuming he appears. In fact, there is some degree of similarity between George Bush and Ahmadinejad in that if you were to meet them in the street, you would never think that this was a person wielding considerable power. And, of course, George Bush is arguably the most powerful man in the world, and the Iranian president one of the most powerful men in the region, and therefore a very important person indeed. But this unassuming manner conceals a man of very deep convictions, a man who, as I mentioned earlier, believes that he is on a mission and that that mission is condoned by Allah himself.
You can read Dr. Sergey Trifkovic's columns on international affairs on the web at chroniclesmagazine.org, chroniclesmagazine.org. Sergey Trifkovic is foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and he's author of the book Defeating Jihad. Sergey, thank you for being our guest. It's always a pleasure.
So it is mine. Thank you.
Well, when we come back from this break, second half hour of the program is ahead. Pastor Jerome Teichmiller will be our guest. We're going to talk about two things that seem to go together, although they are two different things, unionism and syncretism. What do you do when you find, in the first case, Christians who radically differ with one another, worshiping together as though their differences don't make a difference? Well, you call that unionism. What do you do when you find Christians worshiping with non-Christians? Well, you call that syncretism. And we'll talk about both of them on the other side of this break. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Martin Luther is hailed as one of the most influential church reformers of the 16th century. But what kind of ideas drove Martin Luther? How was Luther's theology related to his ideas on politics or philosophy? Luther's World of Thought is our Issues Etc. book of the month for August. This hardback book is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information about Luther's World of Thought, call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find Luther's World of Thought right there on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Learn more about Martin Luther's world and Martin Luther's thought with Luther's World of Thought, issuesetc.org, or 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August.
Radical abortion advocates have managed to make abortion laws so entirely unrestrictive, relying on the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, that in some states, the laws on tanning beds are more restrictive than on abortion.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
In California, for instance, a girl under 18 is required to obtain parental consent before using a tanning bed. If she is 14 or younger, she's prohibited entirely from using tanning beds. But she can obtain an abortion, a drastic surgical procedure, without her parents' knowledge or consent. This upside-down approach protects access to abortion, but fails to protect the young.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Nora Ephron is a successful film director, her credits including Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail, and When Harry Met Sally. John McCasland passed along some questions that Walter Isaacson put to a panel, including Ms. Ephron. Do you have any friends who are evangelical Christians or supporters of George W. Bush or both? Ms. Ephron said, no, I don't. Do any of you know one of the 23% of Americans who consider themselves evangelical Christians? Ms. Ephron said, no, and I am not ashamed of it. I just want to say that. Some Christians will instinctively bash Ms. Ephron as a typical liberal, godless Hollywood type. Such bashing may be what led someone to display the bumper sticker I saw last Saturday, God, please save me from your followers. Does Ms. Ephron not know an evangelical Christian because they are too comfortable in their own cocoon? Jesus says in Luke 14, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. How many non-Christians are in your circle of friends?
Earlier today on our Bible study program in 2 Chronicles chapter 5, Pastor Mark Hawkinson pointed out that in the presence of the Ark in the temple, God was truly and really present among His people. I asked him if the same could be true about God in Holy Communion. If you'd like to hear that answer, tune in tonight for the Bible study repeat, 7:05 this evening.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to take up two subjects. They're related to one another, although they're not the same thing, and we'll sort them out as this half hour unfolds. Unionism and syncretism. I know those are odd words, but we're going to explain them in detail for the next 25 minutes. Pastor Jerome Teichmiller will be our guest. Coming up in the second hour of the program, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Hal Sinkbeil talking about sexual sins, and then we'll continue our series on the Nicene Creed with Pastor Peter Bender. Audio Open Lines is the last half hour of the program. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here in the studio. I got a brand new monitor sitting right in front of me with a screen I can actually read, so my ability to decipher your emails will be greatly improved. I might actually be able to read them for the first time in a long time.
What do you think, Craig? I'm betting he still has problems reading them.
I think he's got some new glasses.
No, these are the oldest glasses.
These are the oldest glasses I've got, baby.
These are bifocals. They are.
I've been wearing bifocals for 15 years.
When's the last time you got a new prescription?
About 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm going to go in and get a new one, but these are the old ones. These are the ones that are barely good enough to see the screen, as I said. They're my summer glasses, though. I'm all about the fashion. I am. I'm all about the fashion. Metrosexual that I am. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Jerome Teichmiller, senior pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Tomball, Texas, and he made a presentation at last month's Higher Things Youth Conference titled One God, Many, or All the Same. Pastor Tyke Miller, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, hello. Hi.
How would you respond to someone who says, look, Christian, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, Sikh, whatever there may be, we're all going the same place. We're just taking different roads to get there.
Oh, that's kind of the theology of the Masonic Lodge, who says, you know, that they all get in one big circle and they pray to the great architect in the sky. Going to the same place just by different roads, Jesus put an end to that when he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. So it's pretty exclusive. I think it was John Warwick Montgomery who said that the characteristic most fully shared by all the religions of the world is their incompatibility with each other. So
that sounds like quintessential Montgomery, doesn't it? Now, let's sort out the terms, if we could, because we're going to be talking about both unionism and syncretism. What's unionism?
Unionism, defined by our a brief statement, says that unionism is worship with heterodox teachers. That's just, you know, worship with those who believe different than the truth that we understand and which we accept.
Then what is syncretism? How's that different?
Syncretism is more of where you swirl it all together and you synchronize it so that you take all the different denominations or different religions and you treat them as one. For instance, we do that when we talk about separation of church and state. The church, you know, you take the Muslim, the Jews, the Hindus, everything else, and say, well, that's church. And you take the state government and the federal government and everything, and say, that's state. So you have a separation of church and state. You syncretize it. You put all the churches together as one. The difference being, unionism is actually a form of worship. Syncretism is a form of definition where you just define them all as the same.
So what is the difference between Christians who disagree, profoundly disagree, worshiping with one another, and Christians worshiping with non-Christians?
Good question. Because basically, worshiping with Christians who teach false doctrine, as far as I'm concerned, is more dangerous than worshiping with non-Christians. Because, one, you recognize real quickly as false doctrine, which can be hazardous to your soul. The other is kind of like the wolf in sheep's clothing that you don't recognize too easily. So, and as far as looking at it from that standpoint, I get more nervous whenever it's Christians worshiping together based on a false assumption that they are united in the truth. Then with the other is bad too, but at least there you've got a delineation of what's true and what's false.
So one is a subtle danger, therefore perhaps more immediately dangerous, and the other is an obvious danger.
Right. The Bible doesn't really tell you to watch out that much for all the Paul's warnings in the New Testament was always about the wolf in sheep's clothing, about the false brother who was teaching the wrong thing. The Judaizers and the Gnostics and those who, the false brother who came among you and taught you the things that you were not supposed to, that they were not supposed to be teaching.
So make a biblical case in response to the question, do all religions worship the same God? Make the biblical case.
Well, let's go back to Old Testament times. We can go back to the whole thing with Elijah. And the prophets of Baal, and he'd set it all up and said, okay, let's have a contest. Let's see who is God. And Baal was the recognized god of Israel at the time because of Ahab and his wife Jezebel. And they had some, I think it was 450 prophets who ate at Jezebel's table. And they were the recognized ones. And Elijah challenged them to a duel for all practical purposes. Let's have a sacrifice and see which God accepts it. he gave them the first choice. He said, okay, you take the bull of your choice, and that was kind of important because they couldn't come back later and say, well, you got first choice of the bull, so you got the good one. We had the one that had a bruise on it, and it wasn't acceptable. He gave them first choice. They got the best bull. And they put it on their altar, and they started praying, and nothing happened. And he started making fun of them and telling, well, maybe your God's taking a vacation, or maybe he's gone. And he was really teasing them pretty hard about it, and they started cutting themselves and doing all kinds of rituals to try to get their God to send down fire to accept this sacrifice, and nothing ever happened. And then Elijah says, okay, it's my turn. He built his altar with the 12 stones for the 12 tribes, and he sacrificed the bull. He put it on the altar. He then told them to pour water over the altar and soak it down real good, not once but three times, so that there was a trench around it and water was standing around the altar. And then he asked God to prove that there was only one God. And immediately fire came down from heaven and consumed not only the offering, but the water and even the stones. So, you know, if there was ever a challenge to say, well, is there one God or are there many gods? Elijah answered that one in the Old Testament. There was only one.
And the prophets of Baal were not worshiping that one God.
No. They were worshiping a false god. And, well, the Bible makes it clear. It says that there's, you know, anybody who worships another god is not worshiping the God, but idols. If I remember exactly which verse that was, but it's from the New Testament. It says you're worshiping demons rather than worshiping the true God.
We're talking about unionism and syncretism. Pastor Jerome Teichmiller, senior pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Tomball, Texas, is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I guess the case could be made by any two religions. Let's leave Christianity out of it for a moment, Pastor Teichmiller. The case could be made by a Muslim that his God, the claims that he makes about his God, are exclusive of the claims that, say, a Jew makes about his God, or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Sikh make about their gods. So Christianity isn't unique in making exclusive claims. Our God is the only true God. Where does Jesus fit into this picture for the Christian? What makes Christianity unique regarding Jesus' own claims about himself?
The thing that makes true Christianity unique is it's the only religion where God himself redeems his people completely and totally. By grace alone, through faith alone. All of the other religions in the world say, well, this is what you have to do to earn peace or to earn the forgiveness of your God. You have duties and responsibilities that you absolutely have to do, rather than God sending his Son to be a sacrifice on your behalf. So the Christian faith is unique in that sense. I guess it could be watered down to where you could say that all the other religions of the world teach a religion of works, and Christianity teaches a religion of God's love and grace in Jesus Christ.
More often than not, now, especially after 9/11, these things became very popular. They started out, I think, as kind of community worship services, and of course, because we live in a religiously pluralistic society, and I think maybe political correctness might have had a little something to do with this as well. We would say, look, we're going to have the community 4th of July service. So it won't just be the Baptists and the Methodists and the Catholics all gathering together. Let's invite the Muslims in. And if we happen to have any representatives of other religions, maybe the Jewish rabbi, we might even be able to round ourselves up a Buddhist, who knows. And pretty soon you've got a lot of religions all together. And the impression is given, Pastor Teichmiller, in almost each and every case, that they're calling upon the same God.
Correct.
What do you make of it?
That's the reason our Missouri Synod Constitution says we're supposed to renounce unionism and syncretism of every kind, because when we get involved with it, we cannot in any way make an honest witness to the truth. just being there on the stage with those different religions says, well, mine is only one of several different choices, all of which are equally true. Take your pick. That quote from John Warwick Montgomery about, you know, they're mutually exclusive. They can't all be true. I certainly don't want to ride a spaceship that was aimed by somebody who believed that 2 plus 2 is equal to 5. I don't think we'd land on the moon. Everyone is welcome to their opinion and can have their own opinion, but they also can be wrong. That's what I believe, according to scriptures, you know, that Christ is the one Savior from sin, and that we worship Him and Him alone.
Someone's going to say, but isn't that an opportunity for the Christian who's there among all the various religions that our society presents? Isn't that that syncretistic worship service, isn't it, an opportunity to witness?
How can you witness? Let's see. You cannot mention that baptism is a means of grace, and that through baptism God washes away sins, because, well, that will, especially for infants, because that would insult all of the Baptist friends that were there. You can't talk about the true body and blood of Christ being in the sacrament of Holy Communion, because that would infuriate all of the Presbyterian friends who believe in the symbolic presence of the Lord's Supper. You couldn't talk about grace alone, because that would infuriate all of the Catholics who have said that it's not by grace alone, but works merit God's grace as well. You cannot give a witness to the truth without insulting someone, and so the only thing you're left to talk about is, well, we better be nice to each other so God will be good to us.
Someone says, look, we're there not to engage in any religious activity, but simply to show our support and our concern for the community.
Yeah, is that the only way you can show support and concern for the community? There are so many other ways that that can be done without being a public show that puts your faith on a line and a comparison with the others to say that, well, they're all equal. The scripture is too clear about making a clear sound of the trumpet, making sure that the truth is taught, that it's not compromised in any way. We cannot compromise the truth of God's word in any way, so it has to be perfectly clear. And any time you get on a stage with people who are teaching contrary to what the scriptures teach, you bring into question the message that you have.
It strikes me, Pastor Teichmiller, there's maybe some naivete, especially among the Christians, about what people in our society really do believe. They seem to assume, if they're going to go and worship with people of other religions or pray with people of other religions, that the average person observing that can tell the difference between a Christian and a Muslim and a Jew and a Buddhist, that they know there really is a difference. Is that too big an assumption to make?
I really don't know. I hadn't thought of it from that standpoint, but again, you're just offering it as one alternative among many rather than just the truth.
What about someone who says, look, we're there to present the truth. We're there to speak the truth amidst all these voices of falsehood.
That's what I just got through saying. You cannot do that without infuriating and stepping on the toes of everybody else that's there.
Do you think it's possible in theory for someone to go in there and say, okay, I'm going to offend everybody, but this is just going to be the way it is. So I will go to the worship service, the pan-religious worship service, and I'll make this bold and exclusive claim for the truth, and I will say to the Muslim, you know, your God is false, and I will say to the Jew, you know, your God is false, and I'll say to the Buddhist, your God, if you have one, is false.
Your many gods are false.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'll go and I'll do what Elijah did on Mount Carmel.
Right. And Elijah did it on Mount Carmel, and it made everybody mad, and he had to kill all 450 of the prophets of Baal, and Jezebel threatened his life and chased him out of town. That, like I say, if you're going to be there, you cannot speak the truth without stepping on toes and without hurting people or with their feelings and without making a real, I guess, a difficult situation. That would be a true witness, but I have yet to see that happen in any ecumenical service.
Have we crossed culturally, have we crossed a threshold where, at least in society, syncretism is the order of the day? All religions are popularly viewed as basically the same thing, and that's conventional wisdom. And if we've crossed that threshold, Pastor Tyke Miller, what do Christians need to do differently, given the fact that most people might simply assume there's no difference between one religion or another?
Nationally, we probably have crossed that threshold. There's very little, everything is lumped together as, well, that's religion, and they don't want to argue religion, and everybody can have their own understanding and their own theology as long as you don't bother my theology. And it's gotten to a point to where many of them are combining a lot of different, I noticed in the Houston Chronicle not a couple of weeks ago, they had someone who had the Jewish, the Christian, and the Buddhist all wrapped in together as one religion, and the person had a philosophical religion that combined all three. We live in a society that emphasizes personal freedom to choose your own thing and to do your own thing, and even to the down to the point to where, to a lot of situations, you don't have 10 commandments, you got 4 commandments and 6 suggestions. It's a very individualized and personalized society, and so everybody kind of likes to pick their own thing rather than what does God say in his scriptures, and how does he guide us, and how does he save us, and how does he work with us.
So would you say that if a Christian really wants to be bear witness in a religiously pluralistic society, rather than saying, I'm going to go and participate in pan-religious services, perhaps not participating is a better witness?
That's the way I would go at it and always have. That's the reason our synodical constitution says that we reject unionism and syncretism. Not just that we avoid it, not just that we don't take part in it, but it's something that we reject completely and totally, and we renounce because it brings into question the truth of God's word, and it has to compromise it whenever you get on the same stage with false teachers, because you're just offering it as one alternative among many.
Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 in West Bend, Wisconsin. Joe is listening. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well.
Lovely topic. I'm very excited about this. I brought out my big stirring stick, and I'm going to stir it up a little bit. Here, it seems to have become rather commonplace in hospital chaplaincy work that syncretism is the way to go. More and more hospital chapels are being turned into secretistic stadiums where events could take place to any god you would like, with symbols from all religions being placed. Here in my own county, I'm having a debate with the local hospital and area clergy over the fact that they've placed Muslim symbols, Jewish symbols, and Christian symbols all into one chapel. The chaplain there being a Roman Catholic nun saying it's all the same God, just different names, and her confessing that this is the official teaching of Rome, to which the archbishop's office then responds originally that it was not their teaching, and now are saying that it is their teaching, that it's the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac is the God of the Muslims and the Jews. Why is syncretism being so accepted as commonplace in our hospitals, where so many pastors visit who reject syncretism so openly?
Joe, it's a good question. Thank you very much, and thanks for listening in Wisconsin. Your response, Pastor Tyke Miller?
I think from a standpoint of the hospital is a public service to where they are trying to meet the needs of all the people in the community. I think that it's the hospital is just trying to be fair to all of many different beliefs. I don't have a problem with the hospital doing that. I would have a problem with a Lutheran pastor who was doing that, because that would be compromising the faith there. The hospital is trying, and we are a pluralistic society. We have to admit that. We have to work with it. Everyone in our society has a right to be to believe as they want to believe. They have a right to be wrong, and so do I guess. But that's the way we have to work with things in a pluralistic society. The United States is not a monolithic, you know, one religion nation, and the hospital has to provide. I know here in Texas, we've got, whenever I go into the front office, I look at there's a pastor's file, and it's got 12 or 15 different pages, and each religion has a list of the names of the people that's in the hospital that's under that religion. And so I can look under the Lutheran list and find out if some of my members are in the hospital or not. Because of privacy acts and everything else, I'm not supposed to look at all the other sheets of paper, just my Lutheran list, but that's the way they have to do it in society. My problem with the unionism and the syncretism is whenever we as Christians swirl the pot and bring into question the uniqueness of the Christian faith of saved by God's grace through faith in Jesus Christ alone.
Well, very briefly, with only 10 seconds, to be fair then, the hospital in question really should have symbols of all religions,
absolutely,
not just the monotheistic ones.
Right.
Pastor Jerome Teichmiller is our guest. He's senior pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Tumble, Texas, and he made a presentation at last month's Higher Things Youth Conference titled One God, Many or All the Same. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
You know, there's no doubt in Luther's mind what was going on here. He, in the time of the Reformation, certainly knew of the three great monotheisms. He knew of Islam, he knew of Judaism, he knew of Christianity. And he would not have for a moment countenanced the idea that they were worshiping, even the monotheists, and what I call in the 21st century here, the respectable monotheists. He would not have countenanced for a moment the idea that the Jew and the Muslim and the Christian worship the same God. Why? Because he knew that for the Christian, God is comprehended in the person of Jesus Christ, rejected by both Jew and Muslim. And he knew the Bible passages that say that Jesus is the only way to the Father. And he knew those Bible passages that say, if one does not have Christ, one does not have the Father. Now, those might make us uncomfortable in a postmodern pluralistic society, but those are the truth. You can find out more about Luther's thought on that and many other things in our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August called Luther's World of Thought. To find out more about it, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book there on our homepage, or you can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. When we come back, we're going to talk about sexual sins. Pastor Hal Sinkbile will be our guest.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.